WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins, live from WFAE's DNC headquarters in Spirit Square. It is the final day of the Democratic National Convention. President Obama gives his acceptance speech, not at Bank of America Stadium as planned, but at Time Warner Cable Arena. Weather was blamed. One day after the president's campaign said the speech would be delivered at the football stadium, rain or shine. A 30% chance of thunderstorms this evening was apparently too big a risk. We got a preview last night of the president at the arena. He embraced former President Clinton on stage at the conclusion of his speech, nominating President Obama for re-election. And as you might expect, that address was a hit.
I want to nominate a man who's cool on the outside. But who burns for America on the inside.
Tonight's acceptance speech by President Obama is the hottest ticket in town. But people are also lining up at Imagineon.
He speaks truth to power, and he cuts everybody down equally, but in a way that makes us laugh and cry.
So who is this person? John Stewart, of course.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is John Stewart. We are here in Charlotte, North Carolina. Very excited to be here. Charlotte, North Carolina, the Queen City, so named for the band that toured here in 1982.
If you want to know how The Daily Show works, stick around. We'll go behind the scenes. First, we spent some time yesterday on Radio Row at Time Warner Cable Arena. It's where stations from all over the country are broadcasting and gathering interviews for broadcast. We went there yesterday to meet up with our first two guests this hour. North Carolina 12th District Congressman Mel Watt is coming up, but we start with North Carolina Senator Kay Hagan.
Senator Hagan, thank you for doing the program.
I am delighted to be here with so many thousands of people in Charlotte.
You are the first senator we've been able to snag, ever.
Well, I am honored to be the first, many, many times.
And you were telling me just before we started that Charlotte is a hit with the delegates.
I tell you, Charlotte is a hit with the delegates. I've talked to media. It's a hit with the media. But it's the people that are here that aren't even the delegates from a lot from D.C., a lot from all over the country that have told me over and over again about the hospitality that they're seeing on the street from the people who live and work in down in uptown Charlotte. People are excited. And I tell you, there's a big difference, they're telling me, between this week and last week.
The people who were at the other convention.
Yes. Yeah.
We've talked a lot on this program about the impact of this convention, the long-lasting impact of this convention on Charlotte, on North Carolina, on business, and, of course, the economic impact of having these people here. What do you think will be the impact? If you have such a favorable impression of North Carolina and of Charlotte, what will be the impact?
Well, first of all, you look at the excitement that was in the arena, that was around the country with the First Lady speaking. I mean, it was infective across. That's the kind of excitement that I think people are feeling being here in Charlotte, being here in North Carolina. But what so many people have told me is that before they came here, a lot of them went up to the mountains and spent a couple of days. And, you know, they all want to come back. And I think when you look at the national attention that North Carolina is getting from media across the country, that it is really putting us on the map for 1 week in every home.
It seems that the weather that threatened the Republican convention is impacting this one more than the Republican convention. And they announced on Wednesday that they are moving the president's speech from the football stadium to the Time Warner Cable Arena. How do you think that will affect the president and the speech and the delegates and all the people who can't get in now because there are not enough seats?
Well, I'll tell you one person who's mighty disappointed, and that's me.
Really?
I am crushed that we're not able to have the 85,000 people that we know were going to be sitting in the football stadium, and they're so excited about it. People mainly from all across North Carolina. had made plans to come here to Charlotte to hear President Barack Obama. And I'm just so concerned about the fact that now we've got to go back and tell so many people, because of the threat of lightning, that the Secret Right. Service has really said we just can't take this risk.
Well, the state of North Carolina seems to be a very important one again this year. The president carried it by 14,000 some votes last time around, and they want to carry it again. And part of the reason for having the convention here is to galvanize North Carolinians. So will that hurt the effort?
Well, we're making contact right now with all of these 85,000 people, talking about the fact that this is obviously lightning related, and, you know, it's out of our control, out of our hands. But we certainly want to continue the enthusiasm, and that's why the president has 40 offices throughout North Carolina where we can sit and talk to people one-on-one, continue registering voters, and being sure that those people who have registered can get to the polls.
You know, Elizabeth Warren and Bill Clinton spoke on Wednesday night, but the convention came out of the box with the boxing gloves on, it seems to me, and the media correspondents who covered the other convention were saying that there was just a palpable excitement here that they didn't feel in Tampa. And yet, the Democrats have been portrayed as underdogs almost in this race. How do you explain that?
Well, I think that portrayal will change. And I think we're seeing that right now. And I think you're seeing the big tent that the Democrats have. And that big tent is representative of what we have in America. And I think now that our convention is here, that people will see that firsthand, and they'll certainly see it on TV.
Well, the case was made very well by everybody who spoke on Tuesday night. But I'm going to let you make the case, because you are one of our two senators. Why should people in North Carolina, the state that's lagging the national recovery, give Mr. Obama four more years?
Well, I think we got to look at history, too. North Carolina was hit hard when we lost so many manufacturing jobs way before this most recent recession. So there was a double whammy for us, and we are still recovering from that. But I think when you look at the fact also that before the president came into office, 800,000 jobs a month were being lost, 3.5 million jobs before he ever got into office. And yet, look at what's happened since. We are better off as a country. Over 29 months, we've had 4.5 million jobs. You look at the auto industry, and there are a lot of companies in North Carolina that supply parts for the automobile industry. That has been saved. GM is now selling more cars than they've ever sold. You look at the fiscal crisis that we're in. You know, we've put forward legislation that's going to stop the too big to fail. But we also know that we still got work to do. We've got to get our debt and deficit under control. I'm a big believer in the Erskine Bowles Alan Simpson report. And there's a number of us in the Senate, Democrats and Republicans, that are coming together to put that into legislative language so we can have a hard look at it and really debate it. Those are the issues that we need to work together on, and we need President Barack Obama at the helm.
Why didn't the president support the Bowles Commission report?
You know, I'm asked that quite a bit, and I think that I wish he had. But I also think that had he gone over with complete support, it actually would have killed it, because the Republicans then would not have supported it. And, you know, you look at Paul Ryan. He was on the fiscal commission. He voted against it. I think had we gotten his support, we could have had the numbers of votes to bring it to the Senate, and we would have had a different story right now.
We are sitting and having this conversation in the convention center in a place called Radio Row, and it's just one radio station after another, after another, after another, doing live broadcasts, doing tape conversations like the one we're having. And most of these radio stations, not all, but most, are conservative AM talk stations from around the country. And I've just been walking around listening to what they've been saying about this convention and about the speakers so far, and even about Michelle Obama, who I thought did a great job, as did Ann Romney, but they were really lambasting her. The Democrats have a story to tell, and you've told some of it, and I'm just curious why it's taken 3.5 years for the story to get out.
You know, I think we are getting it out, but I think sometimes the talk radio have an objective that they're addressing and are not willing to open up to hear the whole picture.
one of the things that people are frustrated about on the left and the right is the banking industry and what happened in banking that led us to the biggest financial meltdown the world probably almost has ever seen. It took us to the brink of a Great Depression again. And so far, despite the recovery dollars that went into it, we're still lagging, and nobody has been prosecuted, nobody has been put in prison, and people are wondering about that. You were in banking for a long time before you became a senator. What should have been done?
Well, I think you look at Dodd-Frank, and I think we have done that. I think we have definitely made changes. I think what happened was, I've heard many, many times that we took the cops off the beat. So there was a lot of deregulation that really took away some of the regulators' power and authority. And that's what we've put back in Dodd-Frank, so that will never happen again.
You came to the Senate at a time when gridlock had already set in. And I'm just curious as to what it feels like to be a senator, and you sit next to Richard Burr, who's a Republican. What's it like to be a senator in a body, Congress, that can't agree on anything? That it just completely stops the business of the country?
Well, two things. The women of the Senate, Democrat and Republican, we meet on a regular basis. We have dinner together at least once a quarter. And I was sitting across the table from Olympia Snowe about a year ago. Olympia's a Republican from Maine. And she said to me, she said, you know, Kay, I feel sorry for you because this is the only thing that you've experienced, your time in the U.S. Senate, this obstructionism that's taking place. It didn't used to be that way. And here we see Olympia Snowe not running for re-election with that as one of its main factors. You know, it does concern me. That's why I'm so pleased that I'm a part of this group of 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats where we're meeting on a regular basis, talking about the long-term issues and how we can solve the debt and the deficit issues so we can get that behind us and move forward. And I also want to say that my office and I, we work well with Senator Burr's office.
North Carolina Senator Kay Hagan is our guest. The Republican platform has a plank in it that calls for banning abortions. Is that a deal breaker, do you think, for most women in the country, or are there other issues that are so important to them that they'll let that slide?
You know, I think that is a very important issue, and that's what I think that is so good about the Democratic Party, is we respect women, we respect women's choices, and we respect them to make the right decision for themselves.
There's an equally controversial plank in the Democratic platform that deals with same-sex marriage, and every single speaker that I heard on television on Tuesday night addressed it loud and clear that the party platform is addressing people's right to love whom they want. Will that play in Peoria?
You know, I think that depends on what Peoria is like. But I was very disappointed when our current Republican legislature put forward the Amendment 1 to change our Constitution. And I came out against Amendment 1, and I was disappointed to see that pass in North Carolina. But, you know, that's taken place, and I think people's voices have been heard.
You've spoken out about the deficit and about the economy. You said that the country's rising debt is unsustainable and threatens America's ability to pursue our priorities and respond to crises. Tuesday night, the deficit hit $16 trillion. And a lot of people are pointing, particularly Republicans, are pointing to the president for raising that deficit so high. What do you say in response to that?
Well, you've got to look back at what caused this. We had two wars under President Bush that were never funded. You have a prescription drug package that was never funded. We cannot keep borrowing from China for programs and wars that we're not willing to step up to the plate and pay for. That's why we, as Democrats and Republicans, we've got to work together. That's why Congress is at such a long-term low, that we don't have the consensus between both parties to sit down at the table and negotiate. You know, I served 10 years in the state Senate. I know how to negotiate. That's what we've got to do to represent the American public.
I'm going to run three quick questions past you. Many people think that taxes have risen under President Obama. True or false?
False.
Many people believe that the president has removed the work requirement from welfare reform.
False.
Many people believe that the number of jobs created has not risen under the president's leadership.
Absolutely false.
Many people believe the GOP allegations that President Obama's health care law steals $716 million from Medicare to pay for health care for all. The CBO says that money is not being taken away. It's savings. So, once again, true or false?
That's false. And Ryan's plan does the same thing.
So why do people believe these things? And we'll let it go at that.
You know, I think we've got to be sure that people can understand what really is taking place. And I'd love the opportunity to talk to so many more people.
Well, we'll welcome you back whenever you can make it a part of your schedule.
I'd be honored. Thank you.
Senator Kay Hagan, thank you for the time.
Thanks.
Well, the convention is operating on the home turf of our next guest. 12th District Congressman Mel Watt lives in and represents part of Charlotte, and we spent a few minutes with him on Radio Row at the arena. We started by asking about the atmosphere at this convention, a very similar question to what we just had with Kay Hagan. Even before it started, it felt positively giddy, and I wanted to know if that's simply because this is a gathering of like-minded souls or because they see beyond the polls to victory in November.
Well, I think any political convention is a convention of the most faithful people, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. And if these people are not fired up...
Well, the reason I ask is because some of the national media who are in Tampa say this is much, much more excited. The people are much more excited here than they were in Tampa.
Well, I think they have much, much more to be excited about. Nobody believes that the Republican Party is really warmed up to whatever the guy's name, Mitt Romney. Yeah. You know, I'm sure that putting Paul Ryan on the ticket fired up a segment of their base, but it alienated another group of Republicans who would like to have their party come into the mainstream again. And it's just an indication that the party is even more indication that the party has fallen off the right end of the earth.
Mm-hmm. And there's no comparable thing going on in the Democratic Party, is there?
Not for a good while. The party has acknowledged for years that it has become more and more diverse, that the country has become more and more diverse, and that we have to listen to each other, and we listen to each other within our own ranks. But if you don't have anything in your own ranks other than the same opinions, you can't hash out these things within your own ranks. You just get further and further and further in one direction or the other.
The Republicans, mainly through Republican legislatures and governors, have been trying to enact voter ID laws wherever they can. They say it's an effort to decrease voter fraud. Democrats say it's assault on voter rights. These would make people wear government-issued voter ID badges or whatever in order to vote. And there have also been targeted purges of voter rolls in places around the country. What are you doing, and I know you're involved in this, to try to lessen this or stop this?
Well, first of all, you know, it's been my philosophy over all these years that the whole concept of voter registration is un-American. They conducted with the United States' supervision an election in South Africa. None of those people registered to vote. And now, of all times, with all the electronic advances that we have made, to say that you've got to stay within your own precinct and register, and that's the only way you can be a U.S. citizen who votes in an election, to me just seems uncanny.
So this is the next step down the road to perdition?
Well, this is the next, you know, what they're saying is, you know, we want to eliminate a certain segment of our population from voting, and that would tend to be the most mobile people. Those are young people. And it would tend to be the people who are least likely to have the kind of identification that they would like for them to have. I mean, how in the world could you reconcile the fact that you could not use a student ID to vote, but you could use a gun permit to vote? I mean, that's irreconcilable to me, you know.
Okay. One of the major planks, I didn't think it was going to be a major plank in the Democratic Party platform, but every speaker on Tuesday night referenced it, and that was the same-sex marriage plank. There are a lot of people in the African-American community who do not cotton to that at all. So where do you stand on that, and what are you telling your constituents?
Well, I'm telling my constituents I've been married to the same woman for 42 years now. I love her, but if somebody loves somebody of their own gender or sex, I'm not going to deprive them of their citizenship right as a result of that. And
did it take you a while to reach that conclusion, or did you always feel that way?
No, I think I've pretty much always been there. I mean, you know, my position has evolved over time to more aggressively believe and assert that. But and people just don't think about it. They think of marriage as a religious ceremony, mm-hmm. and we're not trying to force religious institutions to do anything that's inconsistent with their religion. But marriage is a civil constitutional ceremony, right? It's a citizenship right. And the notion that we should tell people who they can marry, that's an individual decision that they should make. It is a civil right.
Do you think it's a winning tactic for the
Democrats? I don't think of things in terms of winning tactics or losing tactics. I think of it in terms of rights and responsibilities. I mean, you know, and when we start thinking of everything as this is a winning issue or a losing issue, then we've lost our bearings as a party and as a country.
We spoke to Senator Kay Hagan a little while ago, and one of the things that came up was the frustration that a lot of people feel about the bailouts and the banks, and how certain banks who almost brought the economy to its knees, nobody has been prosecuted, nobody has been put in jail. You serve on the House Financial Services Committee. Why has nothing been done? Should something be done?
Well, we've done a lot, but of course we can't prosecute people. Congress doesn't have that authority. And the laws to prove these cases are so complicated. We could make it easier for people to be prosecuted, but I'm not sure I would necessarily subscribe to that, because our country has more people in jail now than any other civilized country in the world. And I think we've got to build in incentives for people not to do these things. Putting somebody in jail basically prevents that person from doing it, but it doesn't disincentivize somebody else from doing it. And that's what Dodd-Frank was intended to do. I mean, you know, to disincentivize people from doing it. And we've done what we're supposed to do under the financial services part of this. We have to leave the rest of it to the judiciary and the prosecution people.
Congressman Mel Watt from North Carolina's 12th Congressional District. I'm glad you found us on Radio Row here. Thanks for being here.
I'm glad I found you, too.
Coming up, how has it been for uptown businesses and the people who work here? We hear one bartender's story, take you to one of the many forums being conducted around town. This one with Arianna Huffington, and we go behind the scenes at The Daily Show when we come back. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Thanks for tuning in to Charlotte Talks, special coverage of the DNC in Charlotte. Our support comes from WFAE members and the Center for Environmental Farming Systems' NC 10% campaign, committed to building the sustainable local food economy through support of local food producers, businesses, and communities. NC10%.com. And Ginger Griffin Marketing, offering marketing and design solutions through logo and brand development, custom websites, and strategic advertising campaigns for over 15 years. Details at wehaveideas.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. One of the hottest tickets in town during this week of the convention is for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Its home base this week is at Imagineon, just down the street from us. WFAE's Tanner Latham attended a taping, then sat down and talked with one of the show's producers to get a peek behind the scenes.
Fans showed up outside Imagineon as early as 8 o'clock Wednesday morning to get a front row seat at that evening's taping. The people we caught up with in line later in the day could very quickly articulate why they love The Daily Show and why they love Jon Stewart.
I started watching it when American politics got so ridiculous that we had material for, you know, three or four different comedy shows, and it helps you laugh about, you know, the terrible situation that we're in.
Well, because there's so much bad news, John has a way of putting the right focus on what's this all about.
He speaks truth to power,
and he cuts everybody down equally, but in a way that makes us laugh and cry. He perfectly articulates our generation, our multi-generations, feelings about life and government.
And that love becomes a rumbling, buzzing excitement once they are in their seats for the taping of the show. And it delivers everything you might expect. Loud music, high energy, belly laughs.
Welcome to the Daily Show. My name is Jon Stewart. We are here in Charlotte, North Carolina. Very excited to be here. Charlotte, North Carolina, the Queen City, so named for the band that toured here in 1982.
But for all of the over-the-top camera swoops across the stage and the rapier-sharp, witty one-liners and biting sarcasm that we as the audience see, there's a very quiet, bookish, understated producer behind the scenes.
Steve Bodo. Steve Bodo. And it's B-O-D-O-W.
Bodo has a thin, angular face, and he's got curly hair and thick-rimmed glasses. Just got that look of a writer, you know? That's how he got on the show 10 years ago, by writing. And then he worked his way up to being head writer. And now, he's co-executive producer, which means
figuring out what stories to do and shaping them and rewriting them a lot, you know, sharpening them. And another part of the producer job is making the execution of those scripts, you know, happen to the in the best way that it can.
At the end of a segment, when the show breaks for commercial, the lights dim and the correspondents scurry off the stage and there's a lone, low light on John Stewart at his desk. It's then that Bodo and the executive producer amble calmly out to the host.
And if everything went perfectly smoothly and we're not having any timing problems, then we're just kind of shooting the breeze and talking about, oh, that went well, and, you know, gossiping about the audience or talking about what we're going to have for dinner.
I have to ask, what does that constitute, gossiping about the audience? What does that actually mean?
Talking about here in Charlotte, how handsome and well-educated and really on the ball they are, pretty much is all of it.
That's very complimentary. Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
No, it's just honest.
Bodo is understated, but he's also funny. For WFAE News, I'm Tanner Latham. In Charlotte.
Well, Uptown Charlotte is full of politicians, convention delegates, police officers, and journalists. You already knew that. It's also overloaded in policy forums. You name the issue, and there's a forum. WFAE's Michael Tomsic attended one yesterday, sponsored by the Huffington Post. It was a forum on job creation, moderated by Tom Brokaw. The panelists included San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro, the director of the National Economic Council, and musician Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas. You heard right. And Michael, I have to ask, what was Will.i.am doing on this panel?
Well, Mike, he had a lot to say. So this panel was all about what is working in the American economy and discussing ideas to create more American jobs. And a big part of that, at least based on the discussion yesterday, was about figuring out how to get young people excited to go into a career in science and math instead of music or entertainment. And believe it or not, that's actually something that Will.i.am has been working on a lot. And here's what he said the trick is.
For me to tell these kids to take an interest in science, they have to think it's cool. Somebody has to remind them that science and technology and engineering and mathematics is the coolest thing in the world. In a recession, the thing that didn't go down was all these phones that we have taking pictures, all the technology that we're using. It's recession-proof. So these kids want to take an interest in it.
So do the kids know that he has this interest in science?
Yeah, I believe they do. And part of it is about the phones, like he said. I mean, he said basically social media is one of the best tools to show kids essentially that cool people think science and math is cool. And it was funny, Mike, at one point in the panel, he basically started name dropping all of his famous friends, Justin Bieber, Justin Timberlake, Bono, and he talked about how they're all kind of working together to try to promote these different things to show that science, technology, engineering, and math are important and that kids should see those as real career paths.
Of course, jobs and the economy are a big topic at both of these conventions. I suppose that's why they held this. Is that why they held this at the Democratic Convention, this forum?
Yeah, it's partly that, and it's partly to make it an even bigger topic. So Arianna Huffington essentially wants – what she said to me after the panel was that during this time, you've got 15,000 credentialed media delegates or credentialed media here, and they're all looking for stories. So what better time to really try to shine a spotlight on job creation? And in her mind, she wanted to kind of make it more about the things that are working as opposed to kind of the doom and gloom stories you always hear about, you know, bad economic numbers and job losses. She wanted to kind of show that some things, in fact, are working. And when we spoke after the panel, here's what she said.
It's both trying to change the narrative away from a fatalistic acceptance of the new normal of high unemployment, but also getting specific commitments. Like, we had over 30 companies, foundations, not-for-profits that have made commitment in the lead-up to this launch.
I do want to point out that she actually is speaking English there. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, that is English.
Do you know what kind of commitments they have gotten as a result of this or even prior to this forum taking place at the convention?
Yeah. In fact, so foundations is one thing. So as an actual example, the Rockefeller Foundation is offering $1 million to whoever comes up with the most innovative job creation idea. The Skoll Foundation is offering $250 million for innovative ideas on job creation. So you've got these actual things sitting out there that's trying to encourage people. But one of the things that Huffington and the panelists talked about as well is going beyond that idea. So you've got a small business owner who maybe doesn't have the money to actually hire someone, but maybe what they contribute is giving their own time to mentor someone who is unemployed. Little things like that. I mean, she at one point kind of compared it to the idea of war bonds back in the day, and how she said you would even have very poor people who would buy these war bonds because it was an idea of sacrificing and kind of being a part of this collective solution. And I think, you know, ideally, that's the type of spirit that she is hoping to encourage.
They have these. They've been having these forums all over town during this convention. Where was this one?
This one was at the Ritz-Carlton in Uptown, up on Trade Street.
How many people were there?
It was packed, Mike. I mean, it was. It's funny. It looked like an actual Ritz-Carlton ball. I mean, everyone was, you know, dressed to their Sunday's finest. There was champagne everywhere. You know, these like big, beautiful chandeliers. I mean,
Arianna Huffington was there.
Right. Yeah. Will I Am, Rosario Dawson, the actress. You know, the star, one of the stars of the DNC so far, the keynote speakers, the San Antonio mayor.
Right.
So yeah, it was definitely a packed house.
Wow. Are these things free to the public? Or I know you have to get reservations.
That's a good question. I'm not certain about this one specifically.
All right. Michael Tomczyk from WFAE News, who covered Arianna Huffington's forum yesterday. Leading up to the DNC, we heard a lot about security and the challenge it would cause. For one, how hard would it be for people to get to work uptown? We wanted to find out. So WFAE's Tasnim Shama traveled with a bartender as she made her way to work just a block from Time Warner Cable Arena.
Letitia Allen lives in an apartment complex in Matthews. She apologizes for the clothes on the floor and the dishes in the sink.
I don't have time to clean up because I have two jobs.
She's an assistant manager at Forever 21, a clothing store in the University City area. She also works part-time as a bartender at Kalu Asian Kitchen in Uptown Charlotte. She's packing a suitcase and bringing a bag full of laundry with her to work. She and other employees are staying over at her manager's apartment this week. It's just above the restaurant. Tuesday was her first time even attempting to go uptown during DNC week. Letitia gets a call as soon as she hits the road.
And here's my manager right now. Johnny, I'm on my way there. Yes, that was Johnny. My manager just let me know that the whole section is, the section of the street is blocked off.
Johnny Evans is the manager of Kalu Asian Kitchen. He wants her to call him when she's nearby to help her navigate the new traffic patterns. Soon, it starts to rain.
My windshield wipers are really bad right now. I have to get new windshield wipers tomorrow after I make the money tonight.
She expects the DNC to pay off. That's why she took a few days off from her other job so she could tend bar. She's hoping for big tips.
We are now on East 3rd Street in Queens.
She's excited, but not really.
This is where the fun will begin pretty soon.
The police are on the corner of the street, on the corner of almost every street.
Charlotte usually has a lot of police everywhere, but I've never seen it like this.
When she reaches East 5th Street, she asks a Secret Service agent for help.
Excuse me. Okay, I need to get on East 6th Street in North Caldwell. I work at 505.
Okay.
She's told she needs credentials. Maybe Johnny can meet her at the checkpoint.
I want to be staying there for a week.
Okay. Can your manager come out to the checkpoint there maybe and meet you? And
20 minutes later, she's still trying to figure out how to get to the right street.
This is too much. I'm hungry now.
Finally, she reaches the right checkpoint. She starts to drive up when officers yell at her to stop.
Hey, where are you going?
505 East 6th Street.
Okay, I need some identification.
I don't have any, but secret.
After she tells them the apartment number she's going to, the officer lets her proceed. She drives up to the next checkpoint where officers inspect her trunk and a dog sniffs her car. Finally, she gets through. She playfully holds up a clenched fist in frustration when she sees her boss at the entrance to his building's garage.
Ooh! Oh!
What's usually a 15-minute drive took an hour.
Now I'm parking. And finally, the headache is over.
She gets out of the car.
Man, I had to get Secret Service to get you through this.
That was just very, very nerve-wracking, Johnny, just to let you know.
It's the DNC.
But I know, but the phone dropped, so it looked all suspicious.
Yeah, and it went out, and he's like, Johnny, your phone just went out.
They share a laugh, but Johnny's frustrated. The restaurant is empty. There's a reason for that.
I was forced to shut down today because we're not going to get anybody in. We're so gridlocked, blocked in, we can't get anybody in. Yeah, we are so gridlocked. That's why I just decided because I'm not going to bring in a bunch of staff where we have no business. You know,
I thought it was a party going
No. It's just absolutely frustrating. You know, the city made no effort. Nobody came and talked to us. Secret Service even asked us, you guys don't have a liaison that helped you guys through this? Nope. The city could care less about us. Yeah.
You know all that. I could have been home.
It is, and like I said, it's the perfect example. I'm a restaurant to where I paid people just to come and stand around today. You know, I'm losing money.
There just wasn't convenient access. There are tall fences surrounding the building. But the week wasn't a total loss. Kalu was back in business Wednesday night for a private party. So at least Letitia didn't go through all of that security for nothing. For WFAE News, I'm Tasneem Shama in Charlotte.
Makes you wonder if they're the exception or the rule. Well, the Democrats have had a number of dynamic speakers at their convention, but none more so than First Lady Michelle Obama on opening night and, of course, former President Bill Clinton last night. Still, it all comes down to what is said tonight. We talk about that and other things, DNC, with UNC Charlotte's Dr. Eric Heberlig when we come back. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks continues on Charlotte's NPR News Source, 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Clemens Bernard, serving Charlotte and the Southeast for over 25 years, focusing on intellectual property and business litigation matters. Details at worldpatents.com. Don't forget you can hear updates on all that's happening in Charlotte during the DNC right here on your NPR News Source, WFAE, and on our website, WFAE.org.
You know, there hasn't been this much excitement about Bill Clinton at a Democratic convention since Bill Clinton was the party's candidate. He isn't the candidate this time around, nor is his wife, but the delegates loved him last night. UNC Charlotte Associate Professor of Political Science, Dr. Eric Heberlig, is providing analysis all this week and joins us again to talk about President Clinton's speech and some of the other events from last night, as well as what is scheduled for tonight. What is the significant, I think, about tonight, Eric, is that yesterday afternoon they moved the speech from the stadium to Time Warner Cable Arena, and that locked out, what, 30, 40, 50,000 people from seeing it who were counting on seeing it. And I was on Radio Row, and I was sitting next to a guy from WBAP in Dallas, a conservative talk host, who was saying, they moved it because of rain, they say. But we all know it's because they couldn't fill the seats.
They had the seats filled. They'd given out all the credentials for it. And they knew that if they had to cancel it outside and move it inside, that would be the charge they would have to rebut. So I know they wouldn't have done this lightly, particularly because having it outside in the stadium was a key part of their mobilizing strategy for North Carolina. You sign people up, you have them text their friends while they're in the stadium, use that as an opportunity to get them to volunteer for the campaign. So it one of the key cogs of having the convention here was the opportunity to engage people at Bank of America Stadium tonight.
Right after I heard that announcement, the sun started to shine, and it felt completely different, like the low-pressure system that we've been under lifted. But then this morning it is cloudy and overcast, and there is a 30% chance of thunderstorms right into the early evening tonight. So we can only keep our fingers crossed for them that they made the right decision.
Well, and I mean, the bottom line is if the Secret Service said you're doing it inside, which is what we've heard, there's not a lot that the host committee or the DNCC can do about it.
Opening night, the speakers that were at opening night were hard to beat, particularly when you ended the evening with the First Lady Michelle Obama, who gave an extraordinary speech for a non-professional politician. I think extraordinary by any standard, quite honestly. So the big payoff is tonight. In the middle, you got this night you have to fill. How did they do it? Do you think it was a successful, aside from Bill Clinton, wasn't it a successful night for them?
It was. I'm not sure it was as successful as the first night, but the first night, the speakers were so consistently good across the whole night. I was in the hall. I thought even for me, somebody who likes politics, sitting there for 4 or 5 hours listening to speeches would be mind-numbing. And it wasn't. They spoke about different things. It was really an interesting night. Last night they had targeted more constituencies, targeted veterans, targeted small business owners, targeted women. So you did have different things, but it was more the predictable pitches to each of those constituencies.
And one of the sisters on the bus was one of the speakers, Sister Simone Campbell.
Yeah, I've thought some of the most interesting speakers both nights have been the ordinary people they've brought forth. And Sister Simone Campbell was an interesting choice as a nun to come in and attack really the Ryan and the Romney budget. And doing it from a biblical perspective, talking about that her charge as a Catholic nun is to be her brother and sister's keeper, and to say that as a pro-life person, that covering people without insurance is part of her pro-life stance, so making a very vigorous defense of Obama's health care reform.
I think I got the name of the organization right. It's Nuns on the Bus.
Nuns on the Bus.
Yeah. She was there and gave, as you said, a pretty effective speech, actually. And a lot of people, small business people, not professionals, not delegates, not politicians, came up there to kind of endorse either the president's helping them or talk about Mitt Romney and his time at Bain Capital.
Yeah, they had three speakers who had been in companies that Bain Capital bought out and were then shut down. So they really made the point that, Romney's an effective businessman. He was an effective businessman in making money off of them. And their point was that he puts people ahead of – or puts himself, his profits ahead of people. And they questioned that as a value for a president.
They also brought in some business people, two retired executives, actually. And I'm trying to think of the first one because I know the guy from Costco was there. Now, Costco is a very successful company, and he was there to say what about President Obama?
What was interesting about his was he's the person, I think, to take on most directly the response to the Republican theme at their convention, which was the Obama's gaffe about you didn't build it. Now, he didn't – or I don't think he mentioned the quote directly, but he said, my partner and I build our company, but we didn't do it in a vacuum.
Right.
We needed educated workers. We needed a transportation system. So it's one thing for a Democratic politician to say that. We expect them to say it. But it has a whole lot more credibility when you have a CEO doing it and clearly someone who's not comfortable public speaking in a venue like that.
Elizabeth Warren, of course, was the second most important person of the night last night. She is the person who put together essentially the Consumer Protection Bureau. The president tried to confirm her to that position and knew that he couldn't get it through the Congress. And so now she's running for Senate in Massachusetts for Ted Kennedy's old seat. She's had a lot of TV exposure in talk show situations. I don't know that I've ever seen her speak. I thought she was pretty effective. She was very relaxed.
Her message was there really to rally the base. She's been very popular with liberal bloggers. And what was interesting was they've had those type of speakers to fire up the base speakers earlier in the evening, both night. And she was in prime time. Her message wasn't really there to fire up moderates or persuade moderates. She was still trying to fire up the base. We have a quote here from her speech. Can we play the audio?
Mitt Romney's the guy who said, corporations are people. No, Governor Romney, corporations are not people. People have hearts. They have kids. They get jobs. They get sick. They cry. They dance. They live, they love, and they die. And that matters. That matters. That matters because we don't run this country for corporations. We run it for people. And that's why we need Barack Obama.
She got him fired up. She also said something that was referenced yesterday in Doonesbury. I don't know whether she's been saying this on the spot, on the stump or not, but yesterday in Doonesbury, they were watching her speech, even though it hadn't taken place yet, and the so-called speechwriter was waiting for the line that she had written, and that line is, people feel like the system is rigged against them, and the painful part is they're right. The system is rigged, she said last night.
Yeah, it's a very populist message, and in some ways it's kind of dangerous because that's not a message traditionally in American politics that's sold very well. It certainly appeals to a certain segment of the public, but it's not one that persuades moderates.
She went on to say, look around, oil companies guzzle down billions in subsidies. Billionaires pay lower tax rates than their secretaries. Wall Street CEOs, the same ones who wrecked our economy and destroyed millions of jobs, still strut around Congress, no shame, demanding favors, and acting like we should thank them. Aren't there a lot of people on the right, particularly in the Tea Party, who might say she's right about that?
Oh, they would say she's right about that, but they also see the same threat from government, whereas she sees government as being the protector of the little people from the rapacious corporations.
I mean this with all due respect. Last night, Bubba was back. Elvis was in the hall. Let me just say that. Bill Clinton had them from the second he walked out, and they were very clever about this. They played this video. And then they hit Fleetwood Mac's Don't Stop Believin', which, of course, was his campaign song. And he walked out. He strode out to that place like he owned the building, not just the stage.
He did own it. I mean, he was the hottest ticket in town. They had the fire marshal had to stop people from going in very early in the evening. He was highly anticipated.
What was his job?
His job was to make the case for Obama as the most popular Democratic politician, as someone who's very credible with working class whites. He can pitch Obama in the way that Obama himself can't.
And also to be the attack dog, to refute some of the things that were said by the Republicans.
In Tampa, the Republican argument against the president re-election was actually pretty simple, pretty snappy. It went something like this. We left him a total mess. He hadn't cleaned it up fast enough, so fire him and put us back in.
Of course, that played well in the hall. Do you think average Americans who are on the fence, or certainly Republicans, will even give that a moment's thought?
Well, I think it encapsulates you know, why the Democrats think that they still have a chance at convincing people, because it's people have watched politics over the last 4 years. They've given credit to Obama for trying. They still like him personally. They just don't like the results. And if you say the results aren't there and it's because the Republicans have stopped him, that gives Obama a chance to get the people to continue to trust him.
He also talked about the president's attempts to get the other side to cooperate, and that he still wants that to happen in the next 4 years. But he also looked back on the reality of what happened or didn't happen because of that attempt for cooperation.
Why does cooperation work better than constant conflict? Because nobody's right all the time, and a broken clock is right twice a day. And every one of us, every one of us and every one of them, we're compelled to spend our fleeting lives between those two extremes, knowing we're never going to be right all the time and hoping we're right more than twice a day. Unfortunately, the faction that now dominates the Republican Party doesn't see it that way. They think government is always the enemy, they're always right, and compromise is weakness.
Now, the president came out, President Obama came out at the end of the speech last night. They embraced, they're not known to be the best of friends, but obviously he's in favor of President Obama's reelection. What does President Obama have to do tonight in that hall? It's going to be a significantly smaller crowd than he had in 2008, and a significantly smaller crowd than he was supposed to have this time because of the space requirements at the arena.
I think Bill Clinton helped him a lot in that regard. Bill Clinton took on the Republicans. He did the fact-checking for the Republicans. He gave a detailed policy speech. So those are things that Obama doesn't have to repeat.
And he did it in a way that only Bill Clinton could do it. It was listening to the policy wonk stuff was entertaining.
It was humorous. I was sitting there thinking last night, you would not expect a detailed policy speech in this type of venue. Only Bill Clinton could pull something like that off.
Yeah.
So what that means for Obama is Obama doesn't need to go back and check the same boxes that Clinton already covered for him.
What does he have to do?
He can give a forward-looking speech. He can acknowledge people's disappointment in the state of the recovery, give the, I understand that, I feel that, reflecting on what Michelle Obama said the other night, and then say, this is where we go from here. This is what I want to accomplish. This is why I think my values, my programs are better.